York, this is Democracy Now!
We are now having 40-plus thousand new cases a day. I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around.
The nation's top infectious disease expert, Dr. Anthony Fauci, is warning the coronavirus pandemic in the United States could spiral out of control as the country records 47,000 more COVID-19 cases, a new daily high. On Tuesday, Alaska, Arizona, California, Georgia, Idaho, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas all announced new single-day highs. We'll speak with The Atlantic's Ed Yong, who warned 2 years ago about the U.S. unpreparedness in an essay titled, Is America Ready for a Global Pandemic? But first, we go to Jamal Bowman, the former Bronx middle school principal who will be heading to Congress if his commanding primary lead remains over 16-term Congressmember Elliot Engel.
Elliot Engel, and I'll say his name once, used to say that he was a thorn in the side of Donald Trump. But you know what Donald Trump is more afraid of than anyone, anything else? A black man with power.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The United States is experiencing the world's worst outbreak of COVID-19, which could soon spiral out of control unless urgent steps are taken to isolate, confirm cases, and conduct contact tracing. That was the stark warning of top U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci in testimony to a Senate committee Tuesday.
When you have an outbreak in one part of the country, even though in other parts of the country they're doing well, they are vulnerable. I made that point very clearly last week at a press conference. We can't just focus on those areas that are having the surge. It puts the entire country at risk. We are now having 40-plus thousand new cases a day. I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around.
Dr. Fauci's warning came as 8 states announced single-day highs, with a record 47,000 U.S. infections reported Tuesday. The U.S. has 4% of the world's population, but has recorded more than a quarter of worldwide coronavirus cases and deaths. In California, Governor Gavin Newsom is set to announce new rollbacks of reopenings after a record rise in new cases and hospitalizations. In Houston, hospitals have begun transferring COVID patients to other parts of Texas, as Houston has become a new epicenter of the pandemic. This is Dr. Peter Hotez, Dean of the Baylor College of Medicine.
It's very alarming. The rate of acceleration is extreme. We're seeing a daily dramatic increase, almost a vertical slope. Some of the models saying that we may be at 4,000 cases a day in Houston by early, middle July. So that would be catastrophic for the city.
A new report finds U.S. health workers filed more than 4,100 complaints about a lack of personal protective equipment during the pandemic, even as hundreds died of COVID-19. The report from Kaiser Health News and The Guardian found officials with the Occupational Safety and Health Administration, OSHA, rapidly closed many complaints without issuing citations. Researchers found just a single instance when OSHA issued a fine, a $3,900 penalty for a Georgia nursing home that failed to report worker hospitalizations on time. Brazil's official coronavirus death toll is set to pass 60,000 today, second only to the United States. The World Health Organization warns the pandemic is the worst in the Americas, where the number of COVID-19 deaths are projected to nearly triple to 627,000 by October 1st. This is Carissa Etienne, the WHO's regional director for the Americas.
As we are seeing countries, states, and cities that do not embrace preventive measures or relax restrictions too soon can be flooded with new cases.
Voters went to the polls Tuesday in Colorado, Utah, and Oklahoma in Colorado's Senate Democratic primary. Former governor and presidential candidate John Hickenlooper defeated Andrew Romanoff, Colorado's former House Speaker. Hickenlooper won almost 60% of the vote and will now face Republican Senator Cory Gardner in November. Colorado saw a major upset in one of its Republican congressional primaries. Gun rights activist Lauren Boebert defeated five-time Republican Congress member Scott Tipton, who'd been endorsed by President Trump. Boebert owns a restaurant called Shooter's Grill in Rifle, Colorado, where she encourages her staff to openly carry their weapons while working. In Utah, the Republican primary for governor remains too close to call. Spencer Cox has a narrow lead over former Governor John Huntsman. And in Oklahoma, voters narrowly approved a measure to extend Medicaid to 200,000 low-income adults, making Oklahoma the fifth state to approve such a ballot measure. In Kentucky, former Marine fighter pilot Amy McGrath has been declared the winner over progressive state representative Charles Booker in last week's closely watched Democratic Senate primary. McGrath received 45.4% of the vote to Booker's 42.6%. McGrath outspent Booker by a margin of 10 to 1. Booker's popularity soared in recent weeks as he took part in Black Lives Matter protests and spoke against police violence. McGrath will now face Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell in November. In South Dakota, the president of the Oglala Sioux tribe has ordered President Trump to cancel a planned visit to Mount Rushmore July 3rd for his Independence Day celebration. Julian Bear Runner told The Guardian, quote, "The lands on which that mountain is carved and the lands he's about to visit belong to the Great Sioux Nation under a treaty signed in 1851 and the Fort Laramie Treaty of 1868. And I have to tell him he doesn't have permission from its original sovereign owners to enter the territory at this time," he said. Meanwhile, South Dakota Republican Governor Kristi Noem said Tuesday the thousands of people attending Trump's Mount Rushmore event will not be required to wear a mask or to remain 6 feet apart.
We'll be giving out free face masks if they choose to wear one, but we won't be social distancing.
Governor Noem's comments came even as a growing number of Republican officials called on people to wear masks in public. This is Tennessee Republican Senator Lamar Alexander speaking Tuesday.
Unfortunately, this simple life-saving practice has become part of the political debate that says this: if you're for Trump, you don't wear a mask. If you're against Trump, you do. That's why I've suggested that the president occasionally wear a mask.
A New York judge has ordered a preliminary injunction against the publication of a tell-all book by Donald Trump's niece, Mary. In a statement, a lawyer for Mary Trump called the injunction a First Amendment violation and prior restraint on core political speech. The book, titled Too Much and Never Enough, How My Family Created the World's Most Dangerous Man, reportedly describes a, quote, nightmare of traumas, destructive relationships, and a tragic combination of neglect and abuse, unquote, in the Trump family. In Wilmington, Delaware, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden Tuesday slammed President Trump's disastrous response to the pandemic, calling him a wartime president who surrendered to the coronavirus.
The crisis is real, and it's surging, Mr. President. Your promises and predictions and wishful thinking pulled out of thin air are not only doing the country no good, but making them lose even more faith in their government. America knows this crisis isn't behind us, even if you don't.
Biden called on everyone to wear a mask to slow community spread of the coronavirus. He fended off a reporter's question about the state of his mental health.
Have you been tested for some degree of cognitive decline?
I've been tested and I'm constantly tested. Look, All I got to do is watch me, and I can hardly wait to compare my cognitive capability to the cognitive capability of the man I'm running against. Thank you so much.
Here in New York, the city council Tuesday approved an $88 billion austerity budget that purports to cut $1 billion from the New York Police Department. But critics say the move fails to meet a core demand of protesters who are demanding a reinvestment of NYPD funds into social programs. In a statement, New York Congressmember Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wrote, quote, defunding police means defunding police. It does not mean budget tricks or funny math. It does not mean moving school police officers from the NYPD budget to the Department of Education's budget so that the exact same police remain in school, she said. Early this morning, dozens of police officers in riot gear surrounded a peaceful encampment of protesters who remain camped outside City Hall for over a week. This is Charles Kahn, one of the protesters.
We know that when we look at safe communities, they don't have some magic key or magic code for safety. What they have are resources. They have, like, some of the best public schools in the country. And they don't have police roaming around their neighborhoods.
In North Carolina, the Alamance County Sheriff's Office has mobilized an all-around-the-clock police presence at a Confederate monument in the city of Graham. As city officials say, they've indefinitely suspended permits for demonstrations and will order the arrest of anyone who engages in protest. The Intercept reports police have aggressively questioned people they think might be protesters, telling them they're not allowed to carry signs. Meanwhile, armed neo-Confederate supporters have repeatedly gathered near the monument. In Mississippi, Governor Tate Reeves has signed a bill ordering the removal of the Confederate battle emblem from the Mississippi state flag. At a signing ceremony, Governor Reeves said he'll continue to oppose the removal of Confederate monuments.
I reject the mobs tearing down statues of our history, North and South, Union and Confederate, founding fathers and veterans. I reject the chaos and lawlessness. And I am proud it has not happened in our state. I also understand the need to commit the 1894 flag to history and find a banner that is a better emblem for all Mississippi.
Under Mississippi's newly signed law, a design for a new flag must contain the motto, "In God We Trust." The Supreme Court has issued a major ruling backing the right of states to fund private religious education using taxpayer dollars. The 5-4 ruling came in a case focused on a tax credit program in Montana that helps students attend religious schools. Education Secretary Betsy DeVos hailed the ruling as a turning point in the history of American education. The American Civil Liberties Union said the ruling's an attack on the very foundations of the separation of church and state. In immigration news, a federal judge in Washington, D.C. has struck down a Trump administration asylum restriction that banned most asylum seekers from Central America, the Caribbean, and Africa from applying for refuge at the U.S.-Mexico border, instead forcing them to first seek asylum in countries they pass through on the way to the U.S., particularly Mexico or Guatemala. The ruling Tuesday marked a legal victory for refugee advocates who challenged the near-total ban on asylum. In Arizona, a letter signed by over 100 immigrant prisoners held at the La Palma Correctional Center near Phoenix details inhumane conditions at the Immigration and Customs Enforcement Jail and a negligent response to the coronavirus outbreak. Prisoners say they're being coerced into cleaning the jail without protective gear under the threat of solitary confinement. A similar letter drafted by immigrant prisoners held at the nearby Eloy Detention Center says, quote, "We're certain that staff are the ones getting everyone else sick. Days ago, a sergeant was a new victim of COVID-19. He collapsed on the job here in Eloy," they wrote. Over 220 prisoners at Eloy have tested positive for COVID-19, one of the largest outbreaks of any ICE jail in the country. In more immigration news, three asylum seekers at an encampment in the border town of Matamoros, Mexico, have tested positive for COVID-19. For months, advocates and public health experts have warned of a possible catastrophic outbreak in the crowded encampments housing thousands of asylum seekers stuck in northern Mexico. A new trade deal meant to replace the 1994 North American Free Trade Agreement goes into effect today. Among its provisions, the U.S.-Mexico-Canada Agreement includes additional labor protections aimed at making it easier for Mexican workers to unionize. This comes after prominent Mexican labor lawyer Susana Prieto Teresas was arrested in the northern border town of Matamoros over accusations of inciting riots for her ongoing support of striking maquiladora workers. This is a spokesperson attorney for the Prieto family.
15,000 workers have expressed their will to join us, the union, in a petition. At the moment, they are defenseless after Prieto's arrest. It's a warning to the workers. But not only that, the more than 3,800 active court cases where Prieto is their trial attorney have a time limit, and Prieto's clients are all left unprotected.
CNN reports the White House was provided with intelligence in early 2019, indicating Russian actors were offering bounties to kill U.S. soldiers in Afghanistan. CNN cited an unnamed source who said the warning over Russia bounties was also included in the president's daily briefing sometime in the spring of this year. President Trump says he was never briefed on the claim because U.S. intelligence agencies did not find this info credible, he said. The Wall Street Journal is reporting the National Security Agency is strongly dissenting from the assessment of other intelligence agencies that Russia has paid bounties to kill U.S. soldiers. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is vowing to proceed with his plan to annex occupied West Bank territory in the coming days, despite international condemnation and growing opposition within Israel. Netanyahu had originally planned to begin the annexation today, July 1st, but the country's alternate Prime Minister, Benny Gantz, is now calling for a delay, in part due to the coronavirus outbreak. Meanwhile, in Washington, Senator Bernie Sanders has signed on to a letter drafted by Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez calling for cuts to U.S. military aid to Israel if the annexation plan proceeds. In Hong Kong, Chief Executive Carrie Lam marked the 23rd anniversary of the formal handover of the former British colony to China with a flag-raising ceremony. Meanwhile, officials banned an annual pro-democracy march for the first time, arresting dozens of unauthorized protesters under a controversial new security law, giving China sweeping powers over Hong Kong. The number arrested is estimated nearing 200. Back in the United States, several women who accused convicted serial rapist and former Hollywood mogul Harvey Weinstein of sexual assault and harassment have been awarded $19 million in restitution payments as part of two class action lawsuits. The women were also released from non-disclosure agreements. Weinstein's currently serving a 23-year sentence after being convicted of rape in February. He still faces criminal charges in Los Angeles. And the author Rodolfo Anaya has died at the age of 82 in New Mexico. He was known as the godfather of Chicano literature, in part for his landmark 1972 novel, Bless Me, Ultima. Despite being one of the most influential Chicano novels, the book has been repeatedly banned by school districts in Arizona and elsewhere. Anaya once asked, quote, "What is it about literature that makes people fearful?" In 2015, President Obama awarded Rodolfo Anaya the National Humanities Medal. And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. When we come back, we'll be joined by Jamal Bowman, the former Bronx middle school principal, who'll be heading to Congress if his commanding primary lead remains over the 16-term Congressmember Elliot Engel. Stay with us.
Patrick Drismond. Thank you.
for Those Who Are Absent by Ambrose Akinmissouri. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The Quarantine Report. I am Amy Goodman in New York City with my co-host Juan Gonzalez, joining from his home in New Brunswick, New Jersey. Hi, Juan.
Hi, Amy, and welcome to all of our listeners and viewers across the country and around the world.
Well, as voters went to the polls Tuesday in Colorado, Utah, and Oklahoma, the results from last Tuesday's primary race in Kentucky came in, and former Marine fighter pilot Amy McGrath has been declared the winner over progressive state Representative Charles Booker. McGrath outspent Booker by a margin of nearly 10 to 1. Booker's popularity soared in recent weeks as he took part in Black Lives Matter protests and campaigned with the slogan, "From the Hood to the Holler." He took a brief lead in votes last week, but McGrath's campaign pulled ahead Tuesday after the final mail-in ballots were counted. This comes amidst a surge of victories for progressive candidates of color in congressional primaries, including here in New York, where Mondaire Jones and Richie Torres are poised to become the first two openly gay black men in Congress, replacing lawmakers who are retiring after decades in Washington. And what would be a major upset, Jabal Bowman has claimed victory over New York Congressmember Elliot Engel, the Foreign Affairs Committee chair who served in Congress for more than 30 years. Bowman is currently leading by 25 percentage points, but absentee ballots are still being counted. Bowman ran on a Green New Deal, Medicare for All platform, and recently joined protests demanding an end to racism and police brutality. He's a former Bronx Middle School principal who was endorsed by Senators Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the New York Times. In a minute, he'll join us. But first, this is part of his address to supporters last Tuesday night.
The impact of poverty on our children and dealing with issues of institutional racism and sexism and classism and xenophobia and everything that keeps the majority of us oppressed is what we designed this campaign to fight against. So tonight, as we celebrate, we don't just celebrate me as an individual. We celebrate this movement, a movement designed to push back against a system that's literally killing us. It's killing black and brown bodies disproportionately, but it's killing all of us. Elliot Engel, and I'll say his name once, used to say that he was a thorn in the side of Donald Trump. But you know what Donald Trump is more afraid of than anything else? A black man with power. That is what Donald Trump is afraid of.
That's Jamal Bowman addressing supporters on election night. Many have compared his apparent victory to Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez's stunning defeat of Democrat Joe Crowley just 2 years ago. Progressive political strategist Karthik Ganapathy said, quote, "A middle school principal with no prior political experience defeating a 20-year incumbent, that's an AOC-level upset." Well, Jamal Bowman joins us now from his home in Yonkers, New York. Welcome back to Democracy Now!, Jamal Bowman. Thank you so much for being with us. And if you could continue to respond as you did on primary night. The final results are not in, but it looks like you have such a major lead right now. What do you think did it?
We connected with the people very early on in this campaign, all people, not just a small segment of the district. We went to Co-op City. We went to Edenwall Projects, Gun Hill Projects. We connected with those who had been mostly disenfranchised and ignored by Congressman Engel in our political system for decades. We wanted to connect with them first. We didn't just target those who consistently vote in primaries. We targeted everyone, those who are registered Democrats but have become disengaged from the system. We wanted to let them know that their voices mattered, that they were important, and we needed their brilliance and experience to help us craft the policy that we're going to be fighting for in Washington. And we had an amazing team and an amazing field program to help us get that done.
I wanted to delve into how your experience as a public school teacher and assistant principal and helped frame your view of progressive politics when it comes to education. We just heard about the Supreme Court decision that is going to make it easier for religious schools to be able to access scholarships, through tax credits. And we know how the education secretary, Betsy DeVos, wants to increasingly provide federal assistance to private education and to religious schools. And in the Bronx, you had to deal with growing charter school chains, which are semi-private, like Success Academy and the Kipp Academy and others. Can you talk about this whole issue of education privatization and how this has shaped your view of progressive politics in America?
Absolutely. You know, I had a front row seat to the attack on public schools, attack on teachers' unions, and the privatization of our schools and the taking of resources from public schools and investments in charter schools. I had a front row seat to that throughout my 20-year career, and particularly throughout my 10 years as a middle school principal. And outside of serving as a principal, I also worked on education organizing with organizations like AQE, CEJ, NYSAPE, pushing back against charter schools, calling for a national moratorium on charter schools, and pushing back against the overuse of standardized testing, because it's been used, as you know, as a weapon to call schools and kids and teachers failing so they can ultimately be closed and reopened as for-profit charter entities. So it's something I've been fighting for and against throughout my career, but particularly over the last 10 years. But that privatization is not just happening in public schools. It's happening in housing. It's happening in healthcare. It's happening when you look at utilities and when you look at the impact of fossil fuels on our environments and how we continue to support fossil fuels and not move towards clean, renewable energy. So the corporatization, the privatization, and the wealthy elite are attacking all of our public institutions. And it's our time, it's our job right now to fight against that.
And you've also been on record as supporting a reconstruction platform of supporting of defunding the police. What's your reaction to the latest results in city council where there's supposedly a $1 billion reduction in the police budget that Mayor de Blasio and the council have supported? But critics are saying this is basically playing with numbers, shifting some services to other agencies, but not really affecting the size of the police department, except for the one academy class that will not take place this summer.
Yes, I agree with the critics. We need a hiring freeze with the NYPD. We need to truly cut $1 billion in NYPD spending, not just shifting that money to the Department of Education, for example, to maintain school safety agents who will act in the same capacity and conduct the same functions that they did prior to the so-called cut. This requires leadership, and this requires a reimagining of public safety and a restructuring of the way our schools and our NYPD currently conducts themselves. We need investment, true investment in school counselors, school psychologists, social workers, additional teachers, especially now as we respond or come back from COVID-19. You know, the learning gap that was there before is now growing. And if we don't invest in more teachers and more infrastructure to make sure we can lower class size and focus on one-on-one instruction and mental health supports, our kids will continue to suffer. So we need a true defunding and a true reinvestment in public health.
Last month, Elliot Engel was caught on a News 12 mic asking the Bronx Borough President Ruben Diaz Jr. if he could speak at a rally after a night of protests against police violence. He then told Diaz that, quote, if I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't care. Listen closely.
Please bear with me. I'll announce everybody. I appreciate you coming. But then go down the list, and it's just too many folks here.
If I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't care.
Say that again?
If I didn't have a primary, I wouldn't care.
No. Don't do that to me. We're not going to do this. We're not going to politicize. Everybody has a primary. You know? I'm sorry.
So I want to turn to Elliot Engel reacting to AOC's endorsement of your campaign on a candidate forum.
This is not a dictatorship. This is the democracy. We shouldn't have one person from high, even though she's a colleague of mine, think that she can anoint whoever is elected to Congress. That's not what democracy is all about.
Janelle Bowman, you got endorsed by AOC, by Senator Sanders and Warren, and Elliot Engel, who was the former chair of the Foreign Affairs Committee, was endorsed by Nancy Pelosi, as well as Hillary Clinton. If you can delineate, starting with the Green New Deal, your differences and how you'll think you'll challenge even the Democratic leadership in Congress, not just the Republicans, the direction you think they need to be going in that's different right now.
Well, number one, I don't take any corporate PAC money. We are completely supported by grassroots organizations and individuals who support our campaign financially. So we take no corporate PAC money at all. We're accountable to the people. We're not accountable to corporations. Number two, my background as an educator has prepared me and trained me to first and foremost serve the people in my district. So while I'll also be in Washington fighting for the right policy and resources and pushing a racial justice agenda, I'm also going to be here serving the people and providing exemplary constituent services, something that Congressman Engel was criticized for throughout his campaign. And then the third piece, I'll reiterate, you know, what I said before. Racial justice and institutional racism is something that we have to fight very directly, very urgently, and it's something that lives within every American institution. So part of our reconstruction agenda involves putting together a Truth and Reconciliation committee to look at the history of racism and slavery and its impact on us today. We see it in police brutality and mass incarceration, but it's also in housing and miseducation and health outcomes, as we've seen from the COVID-19 epidemic. That's something that Congressman Engel had not done. He had not been a leader on any of those issues throughout his time in Congress. And that's why the people have resoundingly voted us in at this point in this race.
Jamal Bowman, I'd like to ask you about the in terms of housing. You've been in support of the cancel the rent movement as a result of the economic dislocation that the country is going through from the COVID-19 pandemic. Critics say that that's not realistic, that landlords also have bills, and especially small landlords, but yet there are over 800,000 rent-stabilized tenants in New York City, many of them suffering because they can't pay the rent. Talk about the cancel the rent movement.
Yeah, if people don't have jobs and they can't pay the rent, how are we going to hold them accountable by taking them to eviction? And in terms of the small landlords, we support, you know, a moratorium on mortgages regarding small landlords, because they are small and they do have their struggles. But we're talking about larger real estate corporations and the real estate lobby that has been dictating how we do housing policy in New York State for decades. We need a cancellation of rent. We need a cancellation of small mortgages. We need a cancellation of utilities. We need to end evictions. We need a blockade on evictions, as that runs out today in New York State and across the country. We need to invest in the people, the working class people of our city, state, and country. It was very easy for us to write trillions of dollars, write a $1.5 trillion check for Wall Street. Very easy for us to bail out the airline industry and the cruise industry. We need to bail out the working class people of this country. And that's what the cancellation of rent is all about. Let's focus on the people. Let's invest in the people. Let's uplift the people.
So, Jamal Bowman, do you think Governor Cuomo didn't go far enough? He just signed this measure yesterday to prevent tenants from being evicted for nonpayment of rent during this period of the coronavirus. But, of course, they will have to pay that full rent soon.
It needs to be canceled. As we deal with this coronavirus and we get a handle on it and people endure what's happening in their lives, it needs to be canceled outright. Not a moratorium, because they're going to be held accountable for that on the back end, which is something we're against.
I want to ask you about a challenge you got about a week before the primary election by Rabbi Avi Weiss in your district, when he wrote an open letter in the Riverdale Press condemning what he called your anti-Israel views. You replied to him in your own open letter. I want to read a part of it. You wrote, The uprising across the country against police violence also makes me empathize with the everyday experience and fear that comes with living under occupation. Just as the police force is an intimidating force in so many Black communities, I can connect to what it feels like for Palestinians to feel the presence of the military in their daily lives in the West Bank. I can also understand the crushing poverty and deprivation in the Gaza Strip. I believe Palestinians have the same rights to freedom and dignity as my Jewish brothers and sisters. I'll fight for their liberation just as hard as I will fight for yours, you wrote. I was wondering if you could expand on that and then comment on the Prime Minister of Israel, Benjamin Netanyahu's plans to annex the occupied West Bank, parts of the occupied West Bank. He's put it off for today. And the letter that Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez wrote that was supported by Senator Sanders and others, saying that if he moves forward, the U.S. should cut military aid to Israel.
Yeah, so first of all, I'm a Black man in America, and I know what it feels like to feel inferior because of the color of your skin or because of who you are, and to feel like you're constantly under attack because of your race. I understand the history of this country completely, and I know what my ancestors have gone through in this country. In that understanding, you know, I can connect with Palestinian suffering, not just in Israel, Palestine, but across the world. And I could connect with, you know, Jewish suffering in terms of their safety and security in their history. What I've talked about from the very beginning of this campaign is our common trauma and our common humanity. And that's something, that's what I'm trying to bridge. That's how I'm trying to bridge these gaps and open doors to new understanding and new conversation amongst the Black community, the Jewish community, the Palestinian community, and all communities, and anyone, everyone who's felt oppressed in this country or throughout the world. In terms of the annexation, it's something we've been very critical of throughout our campaign, the annexation, the occupation, and the detaining of Palestinian children. Palestinian people have the right to self-determination, to safety and security, and to their own country, which is why we support a two-state solution. And the annexation undermines us getting to a two-state solution, which is why we've been critical of it throughout our campaign.
And Jamal Bowman, I'd like to ask you about the presidential race. You've obviously been very critical of President Trump, but now he will likely be facing Joe Biden as the Democratic candidate for president. Your sense, because Joe Biden is not part of the wing of the Democratic Party that you belong to, do you support Vice President Biden? And what are your concerns about how this race will work out over the next few months?
I do support Vice President Biden. Going to do everything in my power to help him get elected and work with him and hold him accountable towards the progressive values that I represent, that I stand for, and that the people of this district and throughout the country stand for. This is the time for bold leadership and a bold vision toward Medicare for all, a Green New Deal, and using those policy platforms to get people back to work and deal with issues of environmental injustice and institutional racism in all its forms. So I'm going to fight for Joe Biden to win because we have to defeat Donald Trump. And I look forward to working with him to make sure that we move the country in the direction that everyone is demanding right now.
And Jamal Bowman, when do you expect the final results to be in your primary race, though you are many points ahead?
We've heard next Wednesday or Thursday, so hopefully we'll get the results then.
Well, I want to thank you so much for being with us. Jamal Bowman claimed victory last week in the Democratic Party's nomination for the 16th congressional district in Westchester County in the Bronx over 16-term Congressmember Elliot Engel, who is the head of the House Foreign Affairs Committee. Jamal Bowman's been endorsed by Senators Warren and Sanders, Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, and the New York Times, former Bronx middle school principal. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, the man who predicted the pandemic 2 years ago, Atlantic writer Ed Yong. Stay with us.
Yeah.
winner by hot chocolate. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. The Quarantine Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. The United States is experiencing the world's worst outbreak of COVID-19. Tuesday marked the highest number of cases reported in the country in a single day since the pandemic began, with 47,000 new infections reported. Eight states, Alaska, Arizona, California, Georgia, Idaho, Oklahoma, South Carolina, and Texas, also reported record daily highs as the virus spreads rapidly across the South and West. The number of U.S. cases have reportedly risen by 80% in the past 2 weeks. In testimony to a Senate committee Tuesday, top U.S. infectious disease expert Dr. Anthony Fauci warned the U.S. could spiral out of control unless urgent steps are taken.
When you have an outbreak in one part of the country, even though in other parts of the country they're doing well, they are vulnerable. I made that point very clearly last week at a press conference. We can't just focus on those areas that are having the surge. It puts the entire country at risk. We are now having 40-plus thousand new cases a day. I would not be surprised if we go up to 100,000 a day if this does not turn around.
A number of states are reversing reopening measures as they face astronomical rises in cases. California Governor Gavin Newsom said he'll soon announce new rollbacks of recent reopenings after a record increase in new cases and hospitalizations. On Monday, Arizona Governor Doug Ducey reversed the state's reopening and ordered the closure of bars, nightclubs, gyms, movie theaters and water parks. Governor Ducey had previously banned local officials from implementing their own COVID restrictions more stringent than the state. And in Texas, Governor Greg Abbott ordered bars to close again last week. Houston hospitals have begun transferring COVID patients to medical centers in other parts of Texas as Houston becomes a new hotspot. Former San Antonio mayor and presidential candidate Julian Castro tweeted, quote, "Texas now has more daily coronavirus cases than Italy when it was a global epicenter of the pandemic," he said. And it's not just the U.S. The virus is spreading faster around the world, too, as the global death toll passed 500,000 earlier this week. World Health Organization head Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus warned the worst is yet to come.
We all want this to be over. We all want to get on with our lives. But the hard reality is this is not even close to being over. Although many countries have made some progress globally, the pandemic is actually speeding up.
Well, for more, we go to Washington, D.C., where we're joined by Ed Yong, a science writer at The Atlantic who's been covering the pandemic extensively. His latest pieces are COVID-19 can last for several months and America's patchwork pandemic is fraying even further. 2 years ago, he warned the country's unpreparedness in an essay, "Is America Ready for a Global Pandemic?" Ed, welcome to Democracy Now! Let's begin with these just astounding numbers months into this pandemic. The U.S. has, oh, little more than 4% of the world's population, but more than a quarter of the world's deaths and reported coronavirus cases. How is this possible? What is the U.S. doing wrong?
It's truly shocking and disgraceful. A country with the resources that we have should not be in this state. And I think above all else, the single factor that's leading to this is the lack of federal coordination and leadership. The fact that that there is no steadying, unifying hand coming from the White House means that the country is forced to fight this pandemic as a bunch of disconnected states. And the response has therefore been weaker than the sum of its parts. That's why we are in this situation where entirely predictable patterns are emerging. You know, we knew that if states reopened too early in the South, in the West, all around the country, without putting in the measures necessary to contain and suppress the virus, testing, contact tracing, and so on, that we would see new surges in cases. And that's exactly what we're seeing now. The tragedy that is currently unfolding in the South and in the West is doubly tragic because it was entirely predictable and that experts had warned about it.
But I wanted to ask you, what about the reality that whether it's a liberal state like California or some of the more conservative states like Texas and Florida, where the leaders were skeptical and tried to reopen very quickly? California was the first to close have people stay at home, and yet it is seeing a huge surge now. To what degree is this a result of the direct policies of these states, or is it just the fatigue of a lot of Americans who just are not accustomed to just staying at home and maintaining social distance for such a long period of time?
So you can't separate any of these things. The reason why we went into a period of social distancing in the first place was because the U.S. wasted time in the early parts of the year when it had warnings and didn't get ready to catch the virus as it arrived within our borders. So the thing spreads, cases start rising, and everyone goes into panic mode and very justifiably locks down to spread to sustain to reduce transmission. But that comes with an implicit deal, a bargain on the part of the people that we will shoulder this financial and emotional and mental hit in order that the government can use the time to shore up our hospitals, to improve the public health infrastructure, to just get ready. And to do that effectively, you can't just say to the state, as the Trump White House has done, do your own thing. You need a federal government who have deep pockets and extensive power to say, we are operating on this consistent framework so that the states may do something different according to the needs of your population, but we're going to act as one. And that was not done. And that means that that unfortunately towards the end of spring, regardless of whether you're a Democratic or Republican state, whether you're red or blue, leaders were in this weird position where a lot of them had to reopen because people were getting bored, because people were stretching the limits of their mental and financial patience. So because we didn't use that time well, the time that all of us bought with this sacrifice, we are now in this situation where the virus was never brought to heel and is now raging out of control again. We talk a lot about second waves. We never even escaped to the first one.
And Ed Young, I'd like to also ask you about possible other waves. One of my concerns has been that increasingly, not just in the United States, but across the world, as the world has become more urbanized, as more and more people are crowded into mega cities, and as the neoliberal policies have resulted in less and less investment in public health infrastructure, are we facing the potential for more pandemics in the future? We're hearing now, for instance, reports that a new strain of H1N1 is beginning to spread in the countryside of China, of swine flu. Is your concern extend beyond the coronavirus to potential other pandemics on the horizon?
Yeah, absolutely. In many ways, this is by far not the worst pandemic we could be seeing. This virus is deadly and spreads well, but it doesn't spread as well as measles. It's not as deadly as other coronaviruses like SARS or MERS. This could be worse. And we are already flunking this quite basic test in a really spectacular fashion. As you say, urbanization, crowded cities are an issue. But other countries that have successfully contained the virus, like Hong Kong and South Korea, other states and nations, also have big crowded cities. The fact that we are in a globalized, urbanized world shouldn't be an excuse for America to look past its failings during this crisis. On top of those things that a lot of other countries share, we add this a strange healthcare system that ties health to unemployment. We add a long legacy of racial discrimination, which means that now Black and brown and indigenous people are suffering disproportionately. They're getting infected and dying from coronavirus far more than other people. We add a specific disinvestment in public health that is not universal, that is very much an American phenomenon, that we have become complacent. We have reduced the money that goes into the people who stop us from getting sick in the first place in favor of treating people who are already sick. And the combined burden of all of these choices left to fester and rot for decades is coming to fruition now. Now we're seeing the impact of all these things that people had talked about and could have been prevented and are making the pandemic so much worse.
Do you think if we had Medicare for All, a national health care system, that it would have dealt with the system much better and working against this patchwork approach in this country, Ed?
Yes. I think it's very clear that that is the case. You know, it's not going to be a panacea. It's not going to be the single thing that fixes everything. The problem with the pandemic is that the U.S. has floundered on multiple different fronts. Healthcare access is certainly one of them. There was a thing called the Global Health Security Index, which ranked different nations according to their preparedness. The U.S. ranked number one, which now, in hindsight, seems a bit dubious. But even then, in terms of healthcare access, it ranked 175th out of 195 countries, one of the worst in the world. So do I think that universal healthcare would have made a difference? Absolutely. As would other social policies, paid sick leave, hazard pay, things that would allow people the agency and power to take their health into their own hands, stop themselves from getting infected in a way that we know that poor and disadvantaged people currently are.
On Tuesday, Democratic presidential candidate Joe Biden blasted Trump's, quote, historic mismanagement of the coronavirus pandemic. He was speaking in Wilmington, Delaware. He compared his response with Trump's.
In April, I released a plan to secure the supply chain for personal protective equipment, surge nationwide testing through a pandemic testing board, and launch a nationwide health corps to focus on contact tracing. Trump's suggestions? Americans should inject disinfectants into their bodies.
So that's Joe Biden yesterday. Ed, in South Dakota, the president of the Oglala Sioux tribe has ordered President Trump to cancel planned visit to Mount Rushmore July 3rd for his Independence Day celebration. Meanwhile, the South Dakota Republican governor, a close ally of Trump, Kristi Noem, said Tuesday the thousands of people attending Trump's Mount Rushmore event will not be required to wear a mask or to remain 6 feet apart. This is what she said.
We'll be giving out free face masks if they choose to wear one, but we won't be social distancing.
So can you talk about this? People say if we're not going to stand 6 feet apart, we should be looking at 6 feet under. Others are saying here is President Trump, who cares more about dead Confederates than he does living Americans. Last seen golfing this weekend at his Bedminster private club. Can you talk about Trump in particular, what Joe Biden is proposing? You have called the catastrophe at the White House. You have referred to it in all sorts of ways. What Trump has done?
I'm running out of ways to describe it, honestly. I think that to have a rally at this time, to essentially assuage your own narcissism at the cost of the lives of Americans and specifically your own supporters just seems utterly baffling, certainly electorally counterproductive, but just a massive moral failure. Like a president should be providing clear, consistent, evidence-based messaging. He should be wearing a mask in public. He should be setting an example for the rest of the nation. Pandemics are already going to be divisive times where people are scrabbling for information. They're looking at each other with suspicion. And we need leadership to unify a population that threatens to be fragmented. But Trump is doing what Trump has always done. In moments of genuine crisis and panic, he is stoking a culture war. He is setting people against each other, and he is thinking about himself and his career above all else. And we're seeing the effects of that play out across the country. The people who turn up to his rally are, you know, are putting themselves at danger. And for what? This whole pandemic has shown us that having someone at the top who is ill-suited to the job and unable to carry out the duties of that office is a huge problem in a crisis like this. If Joe Biden were to be elected, one thing I would note is that all the problems that I've described in this segment so far, longstanding issues of healthcare inequality, racism, if you have a candidate who is running on the platform of going back to the good old days, the good old days were what led to this. We need progressive, radical reform to get the U.S. into a situation where it can more effectively fight the pandemic of the future that we know absolutely will happen. Can we possibly do that with Trump in the White House? I don't think we can. But it is a challenge for any person occupying that office to deal with in the future.
And Ed Young, could you help us understand more about what you've learned about how the disease spreads? We know that there are some people who get COVID-19 and don't infect other people. There are those who are super spreaders. And there's also now more increasing reports that some people suffer from this flu for months and months, and there's a potential for brain damage in some people. Could you talk about what you've learned?
Yeah, so one of the things that makes this virus so challenging is that it can spread from one person to another before the former shows any symptoms. And this pre-symptomatic spread allows it to move stealthily without being easily detected. Now, it shouldn't be a deal breaker. Testing and tracing and public health measures should be able to contain it. One thing that I think is an understated problem, underreported problem, is this issue of people getting quote-unquote mild cases who don't need to go to the hospital, don't need ventilators, but are nonetheless suffering from severe symptoms for months. People who have been bedridden, incapacitated, dealing with rolling, debilitating waves of symptoms for 2, 3, 4, 5 months now. These so-called long haulers who I've written about are being dismissed by a lot of medical professionals. They're being dismissed by their friends and families because we have this idea of COVID as being a mild, mostly mild disease that goes away after 2 weeks. That is very much a caricature. It happens in some cases, some fortunate cases, but it is not the universal picture of the disease by any means. And we need to start understanding what is happening to folks who are staying at home, whose lives have been completely uprooted, who aren't going to hospital, and who are suffering from COVID-19 for a long period of time. We might see waves of medium and long-term disability as a result of this. So it's not just looking at deaths or confirmed cases. We definitely need to understand the people who are dropping through the cracks in the system and the narratives that we're telling about this disease.
And finally, a vaccine, if it were to be developed, how everyone gets it, Ed?
Look, we all want a vaccine. That is the end game. But if you look at how the pandemic is playing out and our response to it, I can pretty safely predict that a lot of people will be confused, misinformed, will refuse to get a vaccine. I can tell you that the vaccine will be distributed inequitably. So that the people who most need it right now, people in nursing homes, people in the black, brown, indigenous communities, will be the last to get it. We need to fix a lot of these underlying issues that have affected America's culture and healthcare system for a long period of time so that by the time we get appropriate medical countermeasures, they can be distributed fairly, equitably, and efficiently, and that they will actually work.
We have to leave it there, Ed Young. Thanks so much for being with us. Science writer at The Atlantic will link to all of your articles. A little correction, Trump didn't go to Bedminster in New Jersey. He went to Trump National in Potomac Falls, Virginia, as the pandemic rages. And that ends today's show. A huge thanks to all of our team working at home and as well working here in the studio to make sure Democracy Now! Continues. And remember, show that you care by wearing a mask. Protect all. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Stay safe.